and Christian on it.
But tonight I am thrilled to have back here one of the founders of Many Rivers Books and Tea, and the main teacher for many years at the Taiyu Meditation Center, which is the owner of Many Rivers Books and Tea. Rob has studied, practiced, and taught in the Taiyu meditation tradition for 30 years? 33 years, which is rooted in the fourth way Gurdjieff perspective. And tonight he has graciously offered, will be offering his thoughts on the utility of humility and its obverse. Thank you.
Thank you. So I'd just like to let our hearts, bodies, and minds settle a moment. So we'll just simply sit here and in silent contemplation, paying attention to your body, paying attention to your mind, letting go of any particular thoughts, and letting go of any particular emotions. So, welcome. The subject of humility is one that immediately leads the mind, at least in our culture, so far as I can determine, in a particular direction. And that direction is a direction which has a lot of unfortunate attendant baggage. If a direction can have attendant baggage. And that direction is the direction of the contemplation of a virtue and what our relationship to a virtue is supposed to be. We are taught that virtues are something that we should embody or should learn to embody, that we should learn to and create conditions to make ourselves embody all the virtues, I suppose, but certainly humility is one of them, the one that we're talking about tonight, we're contemplating tonight together. And that has some inherent problems to it. So I want to, right at the outset, suggest a slightly different perspective on this. And that perspective is a perspective that actually humility is best thought of not as a virtue, although certainly a virtue it can be, but that it is best thought of as a matter of scale. In our ordinary lives, we are very narrowly focused on me. My needs, my wants, my desires, my fears. And I want to suggest for your consideration that humility is about scaling larger than that usual focus that we take for granted, that society takes for granted. More than takes for granted, it even greatly augments that tendency with all the habits that we see enacted around us by other human beings, with all the media that we are that our bodies and minds are blitzed by so ubiquitously, and that those things tend to keep us in a narrow focus. in a narrow scale, a tiny place, a small place, that does not see both bigger things and our relationship to bigger things. So my suggestion for consideration at the outset here is to contemplate the possibility that humility is mainly about adopting, expanding, contemplating, looking at perspectives that are larger than the ones we usually have available to us. Now, that's easy enough to say, and maybe I can try to make it a little more personal here, although I'm not sure how yet. But there are many ways in which the bigger perspectives of life are erased. They are erased when we substitute something smaller for the possibility of looking at those bigger things. And you're all familiar with the choices that you make moment by moment to keep the focus on a very small slice of the pie that you could be looking at, that you could be aware of. So, if we look at humility in that way, then we don't have to feel enjoined or admonished to be good. Be a good girl. Be a good boy. We don't have to do that. Which is one of the principal obstacles, of course, to the actual adoption of the perspective of humility. If the perspective of humility is simply a matter of scale, then why should we bludgeon ourselves with the notion that we're supposed to adopt something that is not present for us unless we look for it? So then the question becomes, where do we find a way, a methodology, to look for reliably a bigger perspective and actually embody that bigger perspective? It's easy enough for the mind to go off into outer space and remember pictures that we've seen of the Earth, of the Magellanic Clouds, of Andromeda Galaxy, and of the Horsehead Nebula, etc. And that's a bigger perspective, sure. And from that perspective, the taste of this tea is a very tiny thing. Whereas if I'm focused narrowly on myself and I don't like this tea, that's a big deal. I've wasted my money if I had paid for it. In this case, I haven't. Or I've wasted my time, at the least. So it's easy for the mind to go big. Not so easy for the body to feel big, to become in tune with a perspective that is larger than the immediacy of hunger and sex and the desire to sleep, to rest, to exercise, the various things that the body is inclined to wish to do. So there's nothing wrong with those things whatsoever. In fact, oftentimes we don't even do those except through a narrow little keyhole of attention. So it's even more unusual to find someone who can embody the perspective of the great heart. The great heart that encompasses all the turmoil within the ordinary human heart and then some. And I'm suggesting to you that the great heart has, by its nature, this quality of humility. Now remember that humility that wears its name on its sleeve, as it were, is a sort of not very convincing kind of humility. A humility that declares itself to the world as a virtue is just human beings trying to get attention. Which is okay. It's not terrible. But neither is it particularly interesting or honest for people to do that. And that is, of course, one of the huge dangers of this initial approach that I was talking about. The danger of viewing humility as a virtue that must be cultivated. I don't even reject that idea necessarily in and of itself, but I do want to strongly point out and suggest that doing so can be an enormous obstacle actually to embodying humility. And that there's another direction to go. There's an Aikido or Jiu-Jitsu move or set of moves that ought to be adopted if we really want to try humility, if we really want to try this virtue out for ourselves. And when we do, it might not feel the way we think humility is supposed to look. It might not feel the way we think humility is supposed to look. We know what that means. Someone is meek, is contracted in a certain kind of way in his or her public face, does not put him or herself forward, creates even sometimes a distance between himself or herself and the greater world, so as not to obtrude and take too much space. That's the way it's supposed to look for people who are being humble. Or at least that's one of the dangers of how it can look. I know this very well because my own personal tendency since I was as far back as I can remember, a very young child, was to avoid notice. And people might interpret that to be humility, but it wasn't. It was something else, a tendency in my own particular case that had nothing to do with what I'm calling humility, or the direction that one would use to move towards the perspective of real humility. So I've got two different things balanced here. On the one hand, there's my assertion for your consideration that humility is a big scale whereby and wherein we can see that what are often called our petty concerns petty to somebody else, not to me, not my concerns, right? We can begin to see that those very personal concerns arise within a context that is enormously greater than we usually consider, than we usually credit. And on the other hand, there's this humility of plaster saint virtue, where we have this idea that we've picked up through many sources, undoubtedly, throughout our lives. Each of us with perhaps a slightly different picture of it, but generally approximating one another, I'm guessing, of humility as being small and retiring, reticent. Those words aren't quite right, but they are meant to point to a direction, to something which is generally understood to be the opposite of what would classically be considered the obverse of humility, pride. And we can see it in children at very young ages. Children who are outgoing versus withdrawn. And people can start to label these things, these qualities, in reference to these virtues, this system of virtue and vice that obtains in our culture and has its corresponding there are corresponding systems in other cultural contexts, of course, and this one is a particularly strong one. So in some cultures, actually, humility is enjoined strongly upon people of great ability and people of great power. So, for example, in my life as an anthropologist and archaeologist, I used to study pre-agricultural peoples. And in many pre-agricultural societies, it was very common for there to be a cultural understanding that if you are powerful, skillful, strong, that you are enjoined not to boast, that you are enjoined to give away the benefits that accrue to one who has these obvious merits and strengths, and in fact are enjoined to act as if your strength is no more than the strength of the next person, so that everyone would be considered on an equal footing, not just in terms of, in our system, we're supposed to be all equal before the law. Here, this was a system where there was an injunction, implicit, never written down, because of these, of course, most such societies never had writing, but an implicit injunction. What is the Japanese saying? Don't be the nail.
The nail that sticks out gets hammered.
The nail that sticks out gets hammered. And that's sort of the opposite way. In these pre-agricultural societies that I'm talking about, this would be a nail that would pull itself into the wood by cultural injunction and training, but still, that's the idea, not to stand out. Any comments or questions, by the way, at this point? This all makes sense?
How did you determine that?
How did I determine
that? Pre-agricultural society.
Well, I didn't determine it. I was referring to the research of many anthropologists who've looked at such groups. And there are a lot of, in the 20th century, there were still a lot of remnant pre-agricultural societies. In some cases, the argument was that actually they might have cycled back and forth historically between agriculture and non-agricultural economic systems. But that's a level of complexity we certainly don't need to address here. But it's based on the research of anthropologists.
There's some contemporary societies that are like that. I read an anthropological study of the Hutterites, a communal group in America and Canada.
Sure.
And public teachers, they in a public school system, people, the teacher will say, and who knows the answer, and then somebody will raise their hand. Mm-hmm. And among the Hutterite children, when a public school teacher goes into unprepared and does that, none of the children will raise their hand because it's considered to be bad form. I mean, they've been enculturated,
rude,
like you say.
Yeah.
For one person to say, I know the answer, and everybody else does not know the answer, would actually put them in a very difficult position culturally.
That's right. That's right. Yeah, so what happens is that people who achieve great things in these sorts of societies are subject to these cultural injunctions to give everything away. So, and then in fact those relationships become the social wealth that those strong individuals draw upon. But it's not the things themselves. The things themselves have to be given away. So that's all. Quite interesting, but it underscores this point that there are different views of the sorts of behavior that we might link with humility and pride, and so our system of humility and pride is strongly derived from the Judeo-Christian view of these things, which has had a long, long run. And I think that part of the reason that it's not falling apart exactly, but it's having problems nowadays is precisely that people see that virtue enjoined through admonishment or injunction is not does not produce actual results. All we have to do is, the very latest thing I was reading about, for example, the Roman Catholic Church is the strong, strong statements of the Irish government distancing themselves from the Roman Catholic Church for the first time ever since there's been an Irish government. Just yesterday, the Irish Prime Minister gave an what's considered in Ireland an earth-shaking speech, because it's not just that there have been abuses of children; it's that the abuses of children have been systematically protected by the Vatican. In fact, that's what the Prime Minister was saying. And so you have this system where the people who are supposed to be exemplars of the virtue do not, in fact, seem to be very good at doing at taking the bigger perspective beyond the one of defending their turf. And defending their turf is that small perspective that I was speaking about earlier. We defend our turfs in very specific ways internally within ourselves, and not just I'm not just talking about the obvious outer forms of defending your turf, the turf battles that we see the political turf battles that we see enacted around us. Those are at a different scale. I'm talking about a very small scale within ourselves, We're defending our turf internally. I just had a phone call from a student today, and it was about, I really have a hard time admitting that someone else is right. And if I do admit someone else is right, then I have to admit that I'm wrong. And I was making the point, of course, that there's another alternative. And that alternative is to move through effort to embody a perspective where I'm right and the other person is right. That's easy to say in words once again, but I'm suggesting that that's a direction that creates a larger scale perspective, which will allow for what would in almost any system be called the development of a kind of humility, which I'm suggesting is really basically just seeing beyond my own turf, however I define that. What a question.
Just letting that get in here someplace before I start. There's this part that you're just going, but. Mm-hmm. I had to interrupt you because I'm afraid that but is going to go on through your entire talk.
Mm-hmm. That's fine.
I was trying to relate to what you were saying experientially.
Mm-hmm.
Like how... And there's two things. One is, I feel like almost everybody has the same experience when they run into somebody that's humble. It's almost like a transcendental in a way. I mean, you just want to... Everybody wants to lift them up and honor them in some way. It's like this kind of universal recognition that's referred to in literature. You know what I'm talking about.
I think so.
And so there's that one thing, and it's pretty much the image that I think you're hoping to dissuade us from this evening.
Partly.
And the other...
Not entirely.
And the other thing is, there was one other thing I was going to say. Well, I can't remember it right now. So.
Well, when it comes back, by all means... resurrected.
Maybe it's shut down.
Right.
But anyway,
go ahead.
I think those large feelings that are universally experienced and written about carry some truth about a recognition.
Mm-hmm.
And I hope that you could synthesize that in a little bit.
Okay. Well, I think this is that you've actually. Touched upon something that I wanted to get to anyway later, so let's jump into it now, which is, how do we know when we see humility embodied in someone else? What are the signs that we would look for? You've just pointed to a kind of, I think it's fair to say, extraordinary humility, which I would describe in terms of a sense of boundarylessness, an absence of boundaries in the heart space of a person, such that he or she can resonate even with the parts of ourselves that we feel to be unworthy.
I think you're right. I'm thinking of trying to think of people now I hold highly in that area of humility.
Mm-hmm.
There is that feeling from them that they're... I can't say it the way you did, but anyway.
Okay.
There is this kind of like boundlessness that... I wouldn't have chosen boundlessness right away. I would have said something about... self-forgetfulness, but that is a smaller way of saying the same thing that you're saying, I think.
Okay. Well, I think that's one way that humility can, in fact, manifest. I would agree with that formulation. But I want to suggest that there's another pull, that humility is not just defined in opposition to a narrow pride, you know, open and narrow. It's not like that. I want to suggest that there's a form of humility that might be very hard to see because it's so invisible by its nature. So invisible by its nature that it does not call attention to itself. It acts in conformity with a perspective that sees the pain and the joy of others and has no boundary between that person and the experience of those qualities in others. But is so efficient at not calling attention to that quality of openness that it might be hard to see. It might be hard to recognize that kind of person. In fact, by ordinary measures, such a person would be in terms of that the in the fourth way would be called invisible in the sense that people lost in the dream of their own self-involvement will not be able to see a person who acts with humility, both in the sense of being concerned about more things than just him or herself, but also in the sense of being aware of more things than him or herself. So that's an interesting possibility, it seems to me, that there may be great saints among us, saints of humility, that unless we're really paying attention, we're not going to see them. We're not going to observe them. We're not going to... We don't even have... I mean, we could develop the sensing apparatus, the specific forms of attention that might allow us to see the operation of this form of humility. But in the ordinary course of events, most people would be oblivious. So which is the greater form of humility? I want to suggest that that's the wrong question. That's asking the wrong question. Because for some people, acting with humility, acting from humility, and embodying it in a way that other people sense and respond to that's their strength, their predilection, the reason that they embodied this time around, and that in fact they have their contribution to make in that way through that modality. But that it is also possible that there will be individuals who entirely invisibly for most people will act in a way that might look as if they are simply withdrawn. They were one of those kids who was off in the corner playing with blocks by themselves as opposed to interacting with the other kids, and they just kept up that tendency throughout life. Yet, Yet I want to suggest that if one pays it, actually observes those people with some generosity to oneself and generosity to them, then a different picture can emerge. A picture where someone can give without having to get something back, and it's perfectly okay. In fact, that's in some spiritual schools and traditions, that is considered higher than the form we formerly considered. So, that utterly invisible humility is something that can be quite remarkable. My teacher used to tell me about this apparent bum he met on the streets of San Francisco once, who he thought was something definitely more than a bum. And I never met the guy, but very possibly that's the form that someone would take to embody that aspect of humility. Another example is the teacher of the great American spiritual teacher Lee Lazaruk, who just died last year. His teacher, Yogi Ramsarat Kumar, was one of these god-mad fellows in India who was, for decades, just, you know, he was a bum. He'd sleep in the train station or under a tree or wherever. And even though he gained devotees and adherents over the years and decades, it was a long, 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 long time before he would allow these folks to create an ashram for him, which he eventually did. But he went for decades in circumstances where his contribution of humility and more was largely, if not almost entirely, unrecognized. So which is the greater form? It's a good question. And what I'm saying is that I don't have an answer, and I don't think there is an answer that you know, I don't think there's a yardstick you can measure people's lives against in this way. Humility is far bigger than that. The yardsticks won't be big enough themselves, because they're emerging out of an aspect of mind that is itself based on turf and defending turf. So it's worth looking at and contemplating, mostly because we haven't been in the habit of thinking about greatness in this way. You know, people think of some saints or apparent saints, people who give their lives in service, as being humble, and that may well be true. But in other ways, you know, I don't want to get into the politics of particular individuals here, particularly. But there have been assertions made that, you know, Mother Teresa, for all her wonderful works with the poor and the sick in Calcutta, nevertheless, also had some stuff that I wouldn't call broad-hearted, some tendencies where she was in fact quite small-minded with regard to abortion for women and what people who differed with her on that subject should be subjected to. She was pretty rigid about that sort of thing. You know, so it's like this is a tough area. And of course she you know, I don't have a problem with people getting flying around in airplanes, you know, by people who are trying to support the work. You know, that's one of the charges I've heard against someone like her, and it's like, I don't have a problem with that. But when I hear that she could be quite nasty about enforcing ideas about her religion and imposing it on people outside her religion, gosh, that doesn't seem very human, humble to me. Much of a manifestation of humility to me. So we need to be discriminating about these things. We need to have a clear view and be willing to... by the way, I don't know enough about Mother Teresa really to say one way or the other. I'm simply talking about reports that I've read, essentially, about her. And who could dismiss the support for people in dire circumstances, health circumstances, that she offered? That's a huge thing. So don't take me as being a Mother Teresa basher. You know, but I'm saying that humility is something that that we don't see very well unless we are ourselves moving towards a cultivation, moving towards a cultivation of a perspective that will support this thing that we're calling humility. Whether you agree with me that it's a matter of scale and perspective in scale, or something else. But I do certainly personally have the view that the view of humility as a virtue has relatively little virtue in getting people to actually act with humility, with what I'd call genuine humility, which is something that is stainless inside. We have a book in here, and we had the author speak here. It's called The Stainless Heart. Heart without stain. And the kind of humility that I'm trying to point to tonight is a humility that is utterly clean inside. And therefore, whether or not there is outward acknowledgement of its existence is utterly irrelevant. Utterly irrelevant to its presence or absence. Now, there's another aspect of things that I want to touch upon as well. And I deliberately left an ambiguity in the title of this talk, included an ambiguity in the title of this talk. The utility of humility and its obverse. In fact, what might the utility of the obverse of humility be? And what might the non-utility of humility be? So these are other questions that I think are worth looking at to help us understand this distinction that I'm drawing between the ordinary idea of humility as virtue that that always someone else embodies, almost never us, really. And even if we do get recognition for humility, how humble can we feel? Isn't that acknowledgement feeding something that's not really humility in us? And is there a problem with that? That's another question. So where does pride come in? pride in its usual sense, of course, is as I said before, a kind of contraction and a narrowness of perspective. In terms of what I was saying about humility earlier, that would be the obverse of humility, because it would be a small, inward-focused me perspective. But maybe there's a form of satisfaction in getting good at expanding one's perspective that does not stain the inner heart. Maybe there's a form of acknowledgement that does not or to put it positively, that actually feeds the further expansion of humility, which might be useful, to get back to that word utility. So how are we going to make all these distinctions? That's the trick here, right? This is very slippery ground, and that's why it's going to take a well-developed form of self-examination to allow us to make these distinctions in a way where we're not patting ourselves on the back for not patting ourselves on the back. And worse, on down the hall of mirrors. And that's always the big danger with these big brains that we carry around. Spend so much energy to maintain. What is it, 40% or something like that of our calories go to the brain? The maintenance of the brain? That's what I've read. And I believe it. They're always so busy, you know. Unless there's something else happening. Or not happening, as it were. So it's some form of self-examination that's going to allow for an honesty that will allow us to make the distinction about what's being patted on the back and why. About whether sometimes it's more humble or more proud to acknowledge a compliment, for example. Some of us have mechanical habits to push away acknowledgement of compliments. And I want to suggest that is not humility. It is the obverse. It is pride. It is small-minded pride. Not that it's a vice to have that habit. It's simply not a virtue. And the step to the cultivation of a greater perspective, an ever bigger perspective, that would allow for the kind of humility to see that I am an atom in a vast universe, but I am an atom, takes into account both the necessary particularity of this existence, where I am focused on this and how it relates to the world, and its relationship, the relationship of its relationships to the greater universe. These things do not end at the end of my finger. or the end of your feet, or the ends of your noses. Mine protrudes a little bit further than most of yours. Is it humble or is it proud, my nose? Well, I used to be terrifically dismayed by its size. So was that humility? On the contrary, it was a very narrow perspective of pride. The idea, the critique of it, such that it should be different. Whereas actually, it's just fine.
It works, right?
It works for a lot of things. Stopping me when I walk into things, sometimes. So, comments, questions, observations at this point.
Would you consider Gandhi a truly humble person?
That's a really good question. And since I didn't know him, it's really hard to answer it with precision. I mean, the most I know about him is of course, the famous movie from 20-plus years ago. Mm-hmm. And the things I've read about him, which have been by different partisans at times. Certainly, I think it's fair to say he was a very interesting man and, in my opinion, made enormous contributions on many levels, not just to his own country, as he wished to do, but beyond that, as I think he also wished to do. But was he humble or proud? My guess is he was both.
Yeah, I don't know, but you know, his sort of giving up everything and cleaning the latrines with the untouchables and so on, and considering pretty much everybody.
I have enormous respect for someone who could do that. It's the opposite of what Mao did. Mao Zedong, you know, had everyone else go out to the farms. He didn't go out and to clean the pigsty, right. I noticed, but all the intelligentsia or whatever had to go do that in China, right? That's not what Gandhi did. In so many ways, his life, from what I know of it, is a demonstration of rigorous attempts to embody ever larger perspectives. You know, I'm not going to be the judge of him. He was a bigger man, probably, than I'll ever be in one sense. In another sense, you know, I have my place. But not, I don't mean my physical place. I mean my place in the enormous scheme of energetic flows from larger to smaller, from smaller to larger, that our minds touch upon when we look at these pictures that I mentioned earlier, the astronomical images. And even then, the images of microbiology. And I saw recently a film called *The Tree of Life*, mm-hmm. and there were things about it I liked and things about it I liked less, but there were certainly some beautiful images of both macro and micro scales in that film. And those are ways in which they're not metaphors that use words, but they are visual metaphors for our minds to have a chance to apprehend what some of the great saints and mystics tell us is happening in our own bodies, in your bodies, right here, right now, in this planet and beyond this planet, in the shadow of this planet and the shadows of its shadows, and in the scales of beings that are far greater than we could ever apprehend in these forms. So, so I have my place. And in a way, humility is finding the balance between the great inner small and recognizing that, in fact, the energies that flow through us are means to go to these different places. One of my my teacher's teacher has used many metaphors for this sort of thing, but one of the ones, I'm trying to remember the specific terminology now. It's basically about time shifting and space shifting into different realms. And his assertion that I'll share with you here is that we're constantly shifting into different realms and just not recognizing it. Every time a new thought pops into our head, a new voice starts talking, that's a whole different perspective. It's a whole different energy. It's an energy coming from a different place, going to a different place. And for a while, we travel along with it. And then the next one comes along, and we travel along with that one. Next one, there's all these trajectories that our consciousness hitchhikes along because we keep getting pulled by these things. That's it. That's the metaphor. And I think there's much to be said for that perspective. And what I'm suggesting to you tonight is that humility is not a contraction of perspective. Enfolding yourself into a little ball and disappearing from the universe. It's actually breathing in and out with the energetic flows that are available in a way where our trajectory does not track to these thoughts, but encompasses them and in a jujitsu form keeps them going in a takes that energy and uses it for a greater purpose, so that we can shift up and shift down, shift out and shift in as needed. It's tricky if you're not used to it. And he actually uses games to try to get people into this space. You know, like the computer games and stuff like that. I don't know how well it works. I don't think it would work for me. But maybe for some of the people that he works with, it does. Yeah, I don't know. But the point is that there have been ways to do this work of creating a different relationship to all these impulses that try to pull us this way and that, to and fro, and that in terms of this discussion we're having tonight, humility is a way to think about being both big and small as needed, as we're called upon to be. Sometimes we get to turn the focus inward. In fact, that's the need. The universe needs us to look within. Other times, I'm making this assertion for your consideration. Don't take my word for it without checking it out yourself. Other times, the universe needs for us to have a talk, have a public discussion, write a book. Yeah.
While you're speaking, one of the ideas that has come up for me is that similar to this idea that Jacob Needleman articulated in Lost Christianity, mm-hmm. which is that his idea was that whereas Christianity will stake out certain ideals like loving your neighbor as yourself, the problem for people reading that is that without a certain what Needleman calls lost Christianity, which is a practical element, it's virtually impossible for someone from an ordinary state of consciousness to attain to that ideal. And
right.
I'm reminded of that when you speak about humility, in that you speak in these aspirational terms, but what are the obstacles for someone starting from a more or less ordinary place of consciousness to attain to that aspiration, and what kind of preparatory work is necessary?
Okay. Well, the I've been trying to point to it in general terms along the way. The first thing is, of course, the need for, as you know, the need for a rigorous method of self-examination that will permit us to be honest about what we're doing at any given time, about what's actually happening to us at any given time, what's actually happening to the impulses that arise within us that we think are us, but that may or may not be us or part of us, depending on how you define me. So that's one thing. A rigorous method of self-examination. You know, in our tradition, there's two basic forms that takes, and that is, number one, the self-observation meditation form, and the co-meditation form. The co-meditation form is a two-person meditation form where we establish and make eye contact with one another and simply put full attention on the other. The self-observation form is one where, whether we're with another person or not, we create an aspect of consciousness, sort of like bicycle training wheels for someone learning to ride a bike, that is an objective, silent witness to everything that arises within our lives. Body, heart, and mind, all sensory data, etc. So that is foundational. Without that, there will be no means to make the discriminations that we've been talking about, and one will get lost, pulled by this impulse, dragged by that impulse, pushed by that impulse, etc. In terms of your discussion about the lost Christianity thing, what Stuart's talking about is Needleman's assertion that we are enjoined as Christians to love our neighbors as ourselves, and yet we are given no way to bridge the gap between how we find our lives and how we are supposed to live our lives, according to this injunction. So what he calls lost Christianity is the methodology that bridges that gap, the methodology of actually creating conditions such that one could learn to love oneself and others as oneself. in terms of humility, we can say that many people adopt a kind of self-critical posture and call that humility. And that is not the middle step. That's what I'm suggesting tonight. I'm suggesting that part of the middle step is creating conditions such that one's consciousness can expand to see that that is just part of the middle step, or even part of what the middle step has to encompass more precisely. So, I'm not sure if that answered the question.
Yeah, I mean, that goes in that direction.
Okay. The distinction with pride is the other part of it, because as I was implying, in my opinion, there are aspects of what might classically be called pride that actually can aid us in learning how to breathe in and out spiritually, psychically, energetically, that are useful and are not to be eliminated or obliterated. But we need to be able to create the conditions for discernment between what's useful pride and dangerous pride, and that is a very difficult undertaking. Yeah.
It seems like this is not something that you can manage yourself. That you
absolutely
you really need a teacher, because how will, even with your best of intentions.
Absolutely, without.
I think it's as crucial.
I consider it to be more crucial than breath itself, in a way. In other words, to accomplish this,
someone who has you doing ridiculous stuff. And,
well,
like
let's
let us teacher.
It depends on there's a new book that I'm reading. It's actually a rewrite and expansion of a book that was called Do You Need a Guru? And it's now it's called The Guru Question by Mariana Kaplan. Now, we're hoping to have her come to the store to do a talk maybe in the fall sometime. But this question of finding a teacher and a school, you know, in a number of different traditions, it's not just a teacher, it's actually a whole context of a teacher or teachers, plus the context of other people who are interested in pursuing these questions in a rigorous and honest way, that is an absolutely necessary context to move forward. Because the mutual support, and I mean that in a very broad sense, but the mutual support that is offered by the experience of others undertaking the same difficult work is just crucial. The Buddha was utterly clear about this 2,500 years ago, or so we're told, in the sutras and suttas. And my own experience and the experience of so many others that I've seen reported and have read about and have heard about and have discussed with others would only support this assertion. So yeah, the proclivity of our minds to both to lie to ourselves, to make things seem better than they actually are, but that's not even, I don't even mean to make that into a pejorative, as pejorative sounding as it came out, It's like, you know, we're all doing the best we can. The question is, how can we create conditions to do something that is extraordinarily difficult to do? And the way to do it is to combine efforts with others. To combine efforts with others. To share notes. To share energies. To share time and attention. That's an extraordinarily important thing. In past talks, when this topic has come up, you know, I've drawn on my anthropological background and talked about how we are social mammals, and we, at very profound levels, even physiologically, we create ourselves in relationship with other social mammals, other human beings, in this case. But it's more than that, even. We create ourselves energetically, I want to suggest, in ways that go beyond what the social mammalian heritage of these bodies offers and demands. And if the notion of interdependence or codependence or interarising, all the many ways to say that we're all connected, necessarily, if those notions are true, then it makes perfect sense that we use the resources of others to create a trusting relationship with people to help us through these areas where it's so easy to get lost in one's own self-satisfaction or self-criticism. Self-criticism and self-satisfaction are equally dangerous, equally siren songs beckoning us to put this aside. Thank you. Any other comments or questions?
My nephew graduated high school, and my mom picked up a card for me to give to him, and so one of the little things that said in there was, like, hoping you could feel the pride of your accomplishment. And that's something that it's been a question of mine, because that didn't resonate as something I really wanted to say to him.
Mm-hmm.
That's like encouraging him to take on the trappings.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What I'm hearing tonight is it's looking at the relationship to accomplishment. And I think when you're saying scale, I'm hearing you say the sum. I'll say it this way: the sum of all things going on.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Which is much more than just the sum of things going on in this little arena where my body is.
Right.
And then, of course, I hear from what you're saying that, of course, me not necessarily feeling good about saying that is also actually a little of my own pride coming in saying, well, that isn't right. Then I'm actually taking a kind of a strong perspective there. You know, not in the grand scheme of things strong, but still seeing something wrong, and that sounds like pride to me.
Got it. Thank you. That brings up several of the points that we've been talking about tonight, and illustrates how difficult this is to find a way through in a clean where you have this sense of stainless clarity in the interior of the heart. So, for example, what arose when you said, you know, about the card saying something about, you know, hoping that you feel the pride of your accomplishment to someone graduating high school, is what arises for me is that for most kids in this culture, high school is not something they would choose to be doing if they could get out of it in any way, shape, or form. In other words, it is an inevitable duty, except for those who manage through rebellion or misbehavior to get out of the system. And it's an inevitable duty that to talk about pride with regard to that accomplishment seems both disingenuous slightly as well as almost manipulative, you know, manipulative in the sense of flogging him on to go on to, you know, university or something like that, which might be fine if that's what he wants to do, you know what I mean? But that's one side of it. The other side of it is that this arena of your disagreement with wishing to or not wishing, in this case, to resonate with that particular communication, your nephew, sounds to me as if you know, we get into the hall of mirrors of criticism all too readily because of the way that our minds operate. And so it's important when you're saying something to someone like this. I guess what I'm saying is it might seem like a small thing, this message in a card that the kid is probably, if he's like most teenagers that age, is likely to go, you know, toss the thing as soon as look at it. You know what I mean? But every communication matters. Every communication matters. If it's not something that's true for you, then maybe you should find another card that will express what you want to say. And then when you say what you want to say, then you don't have to be laying some kind of trip on him about how you're encouraging him to do something that other people want him to do that he may or may not want to do, etc. So what I'm saying, I am indeed saying, and you've taken me right here, when I'm pointing out that there is a way to move through this which does not have to leave you feeling bad. You don't have to feel bad about this. You don't have to leave a remnant of yourself with this card. You don't have to leave a remnant of yourself with your of reserve about the card. You don't have to leave a remnant of yourself criticizing yourself for disagreeing about the card. These are things where the poles of pride and humility contain a message that is not only on one side or the other, but it resonates throughout. And finding that balance in all cases is the task that we are calling upon ourselves to that I'm suggesting we call upon ourselves to engage in.
Question.
Thank you. Got it. Thank you. Go ahead.
Is it so complicated just to say, "Hey, you did a good job. Congratulations," and really mean it from your heart? It seems a simple.
How would? But how would you know? How would he know if he did a good job?
He got out. Congratulations.
He he escaped the asylum. I get that, Betty. See, there's no reason that. Well, but
it seems you're expressing a good wish for him then.
Well, I get that. My point to your suggestion is that he knows what he wishes, and to have to go to some, I don't know, place where there's a formula is not operating from humility or pride.
Well, cards are unfortunate, a lot of them.
Uh-huh.
The cards here, by the way, tend not to have
messages like that. That's right.
Exactly. Exactly. We have lots of blank cards.
We can say pride.
With wonderful metaphoric images. But see, it's important to find. I mean, it's important to find a way to resonate with someone, and by following the standard rules, you're much less likely. I'm suggesting you're much less likely to find a genuine communication, for him to find a moment of genuine communication. It's not easy to resonate with someone who has been enslaved. That's what I consider high school. I consider high school slavery. I consider high school to be one of the most grotesque forms of slavery that the human mind has ever deduced.
You're sprung.
But they're not. What's that?
Some people actually like to learn.
Some people actually like to learn, but I totally agree with you. But high school is one of the worst forms of learning. American high school. Yeah, I don't know about other high schools, but what I've seen of American high schools, not all of them, and not in all classes. There, you know, I found good teachers in American high schools that help learning, but the overall point is, in my opinion, is that high school is, you know, whether you agree with him or not, is irrelevant. It's essentially slavery. It's essentially bonded. Yeah, you're like bonded.
To be?
I was a trustee.
A trustee, yeah. See, there you can. It's the social aspect that most people don't like about having them. Mm-hmm. Be trapped with all those other teenagers.
Well, that's precisely the point. That's precisely people think that high school is about learning. A very tiny part of high school is about learning. From my perspective, most of it is about negotiating these bizarre social rituals that this is my honest perspective on it, and that's
what
why
kind of a high school is
my
this?
Gosh, you must
it's a California
high
public high school.
It was not a parochial school.
It was not a parochial school. No, it was a California public high school.
Much worse.
It was a California public high school.
That was probably pretty high end. That's high school.
Yeah, that's high end. Whatever.
It's a rite of passage, without a doubt. It's
but it's my point is that it doesn't matter whether you think high school is good or bad. It doesn't matter whether you think high school is a wonderful occupation for teenagers or not.
Nothing is good or bad, but thinking makes it so.
Maybe that's part of it, but also it's what resonates for this man when he contemplates his nephew. It was nephew or niece?
Nephew.
Yeah. Nephew in his heart. And
that's true.
And the ritual of acknowledging this particular form is to me not that interesting, because the ritual itself is not interesting. Now, if it was something like marriage, where people at least have something of a choice in the matter, depending on the situation, that's a whole different thing. then you know, my view tends to be a little more supportive. I don't want to get into this judgment about high school and stuff like that. But I want to point to. Well, I did already, but I don't want to continue it. Basically, I want to point to the fact that if you're going to have a kind of humility, in this case, it sounds to me as if you're sensing that that means that you would actually see your nephew for who he is and celebrate whoever that is, which is not a graduate, it sounds like. Or that's not how he would wish to be seen, maybe, is what you're picking up. That's one possibility. You know, the high school graduate. Like that really matters to him. I don't think most of them, it really matters that much. I didn't care about getting out of high school except that I didn't have to go to high school anymore. But so what?
Thank God.
Yeah. I don't consider that to be something to offer congratulations to someone about. That they're no longer a slave, you know, 6 hours a day.
Okay.
And then I get to be a slave 8 and 10 and 12 hours a day.
Hey, yeah. Let me tell you, I found that out myself, and it was a whole different matter. But that's the point, we are trying to negotiate humility and pride in life experiences that seem to be forcing us to do things that in our hearts we don't want to do. So how do we deal with that? And I'm saying, and the reason that I was moved to emphasize this point about disagreeing with the nature of high school and with some of you folks is that this is the heart of the matter. There is a being need, in my opinion, you don't have to agree, there is a being need to find a way to do and express something unique for each of us. And to find the way to do that in the constraints that are imposed upon us by society is not an easy thing. Our society preaches that we are rugged individualists and have all this freedom. I'm telling you, when I was a teenager, I did not feel free. I think that's a big crock of you-know-what.
I'm going to have to believe it.
What's that?
You don't have to believe it.
Uh-huh, but you're essentially adopting the position that you're supposed to congratulate someone for having done well with the crock of you-know-what.
Is there anything problem with the use of the word pride? Mm-hmm. It wasn't, the thing wasn't high school, it was that the card said about pride. And we were talking about
word,
humility.
The thing that bugged
proud,
you
yeah.
The I think
card.
That's the little
bit proud of your accomplishment.
Whether or not
hope you can be proud of your accomplishment.
High school is worth anything.
And that's the point. It's like that's suggesting that one's acquiescence to something that one has to acquiesce to anyway, pretty much, but nevertheless is not at congruent necessarily with one's heart's desire is a very difficult human problem. And I'm further suggesting that there is a way through self-examination to negotiate and learn how to negotiate between one's heart's desire and all the exterior forms such that one is honest with all of those exterior manifestations and one's interior truth. And so it's really important, I think. It's crucially important to take these things seriously, because a phrase just arose that'll really set you off. I consider most high school to be child abuse, actually. It's true, in my opinion. It's teenager abuse.
You must have gone to a heck of a
high school. Oh my gosh, I got that.
I got that.
I think it's easier for women to play along with the rules than for men.
What's that? Say that again.
It's easier for women to go along with the rules than for men.
That may well be.
Yeah.
But it isn't even the rules. It's the rules and the unspoken rules.
Yeah.
So what I'm saying is find a way to be true to this inner heart that can resonate for another human being, and I don't care about the ideas that people have about success in the outer world. That's what I'm saying. Pride and humility are completely implicated in this. They're inescapable in this. You know, is it right to tell someone to be proud for having submitted and ground oneself through something that may or may not have been terrible? But surely is not as one would have wished to live one's life if those constraints were absent. And we all continue to deal with this. Our lives all have constraints. So how do we figure out how to live within those constraints? And I'm saying there's a way to do it where you don't sacrifice the integrity that some people identify with pride, but that I'm suggesting can be parlayed into humility by resonating with larger things than just sets of constraints offered by society. And constraints offered by society is mostly what society has to offer. Go ahead.
Okay, a woman's viewpoint on this. First, you don't want to hurt your nephew's feelings. You are fond of him, I trust. Or not. In any case, rule number one is you don't want to hurt his feelings. That's just rule number one in life, I think.
I didn't hear what you said.
Not to cause pain to someone else. This is a woman speaking. This is rule number one in life.
Uh-huh. Well, according to what I just said, he would have been causing him pain. So then he should shut up. Rule number one would be to do no harm.
Get a blank card and just say, good luck, buddy.
And buy it here.
Buy it here.
We got that problem solved. There you go.
Good luck, buddy. We can go along with that.
You don't have to say anything other than you're thinking about him and wishing him well. Is what you're doing.
Well, that's a perfectly fine thing.
But if I just to get back to your original point, if I understand you, the particulars are irrelevant to this.
Right.
The particular formulation of what to say is irrelevant.
Right.
The reality is what's in your heart.
That's
and what
true.
Is it you want to express, and how does that resonate with the heart of your nephew? You know, it's possible, I can dream up scenarios where it's important for the cultivation of an appropriate, balanced personality to affirm for your nephew a success, which they need at that time as a somewhat insecure 18-year-old. It's possible that they're so mature that they would appreciate a more nuanced response from you because they feel, as Rob was saying, that this is a little bit like you know, BS that they went through, and recognizing that and yet acknowledging the sort of outer achievement might be something as well. But none of that matters. None of that, you know, that's just my head speaking, you know, that doesn't matter. It's your point is, what is coming from the heart in the moment that you actually do the gesture? And the other, I guess the other point that I get from you is that life is filled with a myriad of small little things like this.
That's right.
And each one in this path that you're describing is critically important. The big things, the big lofty discussions of pride and humility on the cosmic scale are irrelevant. In one sense, what's really important is moment by moment to instantiate the putting into practice of those ideas from your heart and not from your head.
Thank you. I think that's nicely said, and I think that would be a just fine point to end on. The love that you feel for your nephew, as I presume you do, surely looks like it, is it will lead you to act or give you what you need to know when you do whatever you do with them. And how you do it is just as important as what you do. In fact, it's more important, in my opinion, how you do it. How you maintain this sense of love and well-being is really, and have it be stainless in the way I was talking about earlier, is really the biggest gift you can give him and yourself. Because then you won't have any second thoughts. You won't have this, I mean, you know, I'm not saying you won't have any second thoughts, really. But you don't have to believe them. You don't have to believe that those second thoughts are something that really is worthy of you following them and being run by them and surrendering your autonomy to them. So is humility a surrender, or is it standing cleanly on the ground and knowing where you are standing? That's a question I think is a good one to leave us all with. Thank you for the question.
Thank you, Rob.
Thank you, Rob.
Thank you.